Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
And words cannot express how much I love you.
And employees and customers return that love as Arthur T. Demoulas closes a $1.5 billion deal and takes the helm again at Market Basket. This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Also in our Week in Review today, sharp words in a close political race as primary day looms.
Warren, look, you've never prosecuted a crime. I have. You've never handled a civil rights investigation. I have. So I find it hard to listen to you. Well, I find it hard to be lectured by you on this.
And after almost 2 years held hostage in Syria, a journalist is home again in Cambridge.
I am just overwhelmed with emotion. Total strangers have been coming up to me and saying, hey, we're just glad you're home. Welcome home.
And following a tragedy at a Boston parade, a bereaved father reaches out to the shooter who killed his daughter.
If you could turn back the hands of time and maybe have picked up a book instead of picked up a gun at such a festive occasion, it would have been, we wouldn't all have to be here.
So we've got a lot of ground to cover in our Week in Review today, and joining us to do so is Jeff Jacoby, columnist for the Boston Globe. Good to see you as always, Jeff.
Hello, Meghna.
Also joining us is John Carroll, professor of communications at Boston University and the man behind the Campaign Outsider blog. John, great to see you again, too.
Always good to be back.
All right, so let's start with Market Basket, the big deal that was closed this week, the $1.5 billion deal that puts Arthur T. Demoulas back in as CEO, and he and his sisters now basically own the whole company outright. The deal is what the New York Times called one of the strangest labor actions in American business history. Okay, and of course, that follows 6 weeks of demonstrations and protests by many Market Basket employees and customers and suppliers. So the Demoulas family feud is over for now. Stores are currently restocking. But what's the legacy of this dispute, and why did so many people like customer Jardana Laurent from Somerville actually cast this big battle in ideological terms?
There are few and far between examples where people and employees and customers stand together and something is actually accomplished. It seemed for a while like there was no way this could ever end well for the store and for a family. I mean, it really, the prices make a difference, and so it's just, from an ideological standpoint, it's nice to see that people can make a difference.
Okay, John, let's start with you. What aspect of the story resonated the most with you, and why do you think people see it from this ideological standpoint?
Well, I think it was a battle over an approach to business that that had opposite ends of the spectrum, dueling with each other. I mean, I thought from the very start that if this were a Little League game, they would have invoked the mercy rule because it was so one-sided. There was no alternative storyline presented by the Arthur S. forces, and the public was overwhelmingly behind the workers. And I think that was a big part of it. But the biggest part of it was the solidarity of the customers and the workers and the perseverance. I mean, they kept getting, this is your final chance to come back to work, otherwise you're going to be fired. And they didn't go back to work. And I think the board and Arthur S. underestimated how entrenched they were in this battle. They thought they could wait it out. They realized that they couldn't wait it out. And now they have a deal that they could have had 5 weeks ago.
Hmm. Jeff, what's your take on it?
Well, since we're heading into Labor Day, I suppose we might make the ideological point that this just goes to show what solidarity among workers can do when they don't have a union to get in the way. This is a non-union company, and it's just a reminder to those who sometimes think in big union towns like Boston that you can't accomplish anything if there's not a union telling you what to do, that's not always the case. I would also say it's not only about employees, and it's not only about the general public following the news, but I think a substantial measure of credit goes to customers.
Yes.
The fact that customers were so quick to line up behind the boycott and have been so effusive about something that they can't wait to get back, that also says something about the management style that they reacted to and were attracted to.
Well, this is one of the reasons, exactly this reason is one of the issues behind why a lot of people are wondering, could this happen anywhere else? I mean, how many other supermarket chains or like businesses have a customer base that's this loyal?
And it's a funny thing. Everybody goes to a supermarket. You've got to go buy your groceries. And I wonder, what is it, those of us who go to supermarkets and find it a really maddening experience, And yes, Stop and Shop in South Bay, I'm talking about you. Why don't managers of stores like that look at what kind of loyalty and enthusiasm and affection Market Basket was able to generate and adapt some of that?
This was a particular moment. This isn't reproducible. This is not going to happen at Walmart. It's not going to happen at Stop and Shop. It's not going to happen anywhere, because this was a particular combination of price, loyalty, and determination, and all three of those things were things that factored into this. The question is, will the employees be disappointed because the Arthur T who's coming back is not the Arthur T who left? And will the customers be disappointed because they've got a whole different business model now?
Right. So whether or not, nevertheless, I mean, a lot of people think that the past 6 weeks have basically been a giant case study in how to run a business and how to engender the kind of loyalty that we've been talking about. I mean, even Arthur T. Demoulas, when he finally spoke to employees after the deal was inked, he was in Tewksbury, he, in his entire speech, which he hadn't actually spoken to anybody publicly in the 6 weeks that all this was going on, he really kept his focus on the employees, his awe and his love and respect for them. And he talked about how the success of the demonstrators, in his words, had taught CEOs, business professors, journalists, and politicians a powerful lesson.
We taught everybody that here at Market Basket, it's a place where you respect and honor and dignity is a way of life.
So Arthur T. Demoulas, they're talking about respect, honor, and dignity as a way of life.
In 20 years, I can't think of another case like this other than the Aaron Feuerstein saga at Malden Mills. Do you remember that?
Oh, sure, where he kept paying his employees.
He stepped in,
even though the
fire,
mill had burned down,
and,
right.
And also became a national hero in the light. Yeah. This isn't quite the same kind of thing, but that sense of really unusual and powerful loyalty and a bond between owner and workers is something to think about. Going into a Labor Day weekend, just, you know, when we think about things like labor management.
This is a situation where Arthur T. Demoulas cannot do what he did before. He has $1 billion with a debt service that he's got to meet, and he also, every dollar that he gave to his employees and every dollar that he took off the prices for his customers, 50 cents of that dollar came from Arthur S. Demoulas.
Right.
You know, now the whole dollar comes from him. So I think that he's got a whole different set of circumstances to deal with now. And it's going to be interesting to see if he can actually recover, or if he's going to be more like Stop and Shop or Hannaford's than the Market Basket of all.
And isn't there a private equity firm that's now,
yes,
now
there
owns a
is.
Third of it or something like that?
Well, yes,
half a billion?
They put in $500 million. Exactly. And so this is the big question now, because initially when Arthur T. was ousted, part of the concern from employees was that exactly this kind of investor would step in. Well, it turns out that is what has happened. So we talked to Northeastern professor Ted Clark yesterday, and he said that these equity investors may be even more demanding than other possible owners might have been. So let's listen.
There'll be a lot of pressure for returns, and there'll be a lot of pressure for bottom line results from professionals who will be expecting answers on a regular basis. That's an assumption that I have.
Okay, so Jeff and John, just really quickly, I mean, Ted Clark ended up calling it a Pyrrhic victory, maybe, that the very things that employees fought for because they loved about the culture of the working culture of Market Basket might be the things that go as these returns have to be met with these equity investors.
It would be a Pyrrhic and ironic outcome if that's what it turned out to be. Sitting here, I don't think any of us knows, but it's certainly a reasonable question.
I think what they're going to try to do is return Market Basket to as close to what it was before as they possibly can, and then see if that's sustainable. And if it's not, it's going to be the slow drip of higher prices and higher returns for the investors.
All right, well, let's move on to politics now, with the primaries just a week and a half or so to go. This week we had a couple surprises. First of all, in a close and contentious race for Attorney General, we've got John Miller running on the Republican side, but really all the heat is on the Democratic side, because former Deputy Attorney General Maura Healey is running against former State Senator Warren Tolman. They had a debate this week at the Boston Globe, which got rather testy.
We're running for the office of Attorney General. the chief law enforcement officer of the Commonwealth.
I know, I've been there.
And you haven't been Attorney General. You were one of several hundred people that worked under the auspices of the Attorney General.
Warren, I ran half of that office.
Okay, John, so that's just a taste of what that most of that debate was like. And they're rather close in policy. They do have different backgrounds, but Tolman seems to be up by at least a couple of points in a poll this week. What's your read on the race?
Well, I think it's a lot closer than anybody ever expected it to be, especially Warren Tolman. And I think that that's making both candidates do things differently than they might have otherwise. So Maura Healey senses that this is something that she can actually win. And she's tried to draw as clear a distinction between herself and Tolman as possible. Tolman talks about, the leadership aspect of the Attorney General's office. Maura Healey talks about the litigation aspect of it. So he's talking about legislation. She's talking about litigation. She's trying to make it as clear a choice as possible for the people who are going to the voting booth on September 9th.
Right. And Jeff, there was that moment in the debate where Warren Tolman used the word unbecoming.
Ooh, the terrible you word.
And a lot of female politicians and representatives.
Now, Megna, tell me that doesn't embarrass you.
Why?
To turn a perfectly ordinary, sensible, commonplace English word into some kind of an anti-woman insult. The whole thing seems
but
so
the word is rarely used for men, though. And as Joan
like,
Vanocki, your colleague at the Globe pointed out this week, this is a word that has history in Massachusetts.
Rarely used against men, as in conduct unbecoming an officer. For example,
I'll accept
behavior
that.
Unbecoming a member of the U.S. Senate. We use that word. It's just an ordinary word. It would be as if somebody had said, there was the chink in his armor is what? You said the word chink in a sense that can be twisted somehow to manufacture indignation that doesn't exist. They were having a heated back and forth. She kept going back to a point that he wanted to move on from. He said, it's unbecoming for you to keep conducting this debate that way. I thought to turn that into some kind of a male-female thing was silly.
But on the other hand, I mean, the moment didn't seem to last very long, John. It didn't have the same lift in terms of helping Healey in the polls or maybe gathering more support for her.
And as Joan Vanocki pointed out, it didn't have much, didn't help Shannon O'Brien very much either when she had the same dust-up with Mitt Romney. I mean, this is the Umbridge industrial complex springing into action immediately. And I think it flared out pretty quickly because there's not a whole lot of there. I mean, is it dismissive to some degree? Yes. Has Maura Healey been dismissive of Warren Tolman? Yes. She didn't use the same language, but both of them have done the same thing to each other. So I think that, this is one of those things that's easy to latch onto. It's easy to attach a hashtag to, but there's not a whole lot of there.
Someone's going to send me a tweet saying it was unbecoming of me for even bringing it up today. Okay.
Well, as long as they don't say that about me.
I think we should get the bumper stickers or T-shirts that will say, pronounce as charter members of the Umbridge Industrial Complex. I like that. That's a good term.
Well, Jeff, let's turn to the governor's race because a poll out today from the Globe shows Republican Charlie Baker basically tied, if not edging out, Democrat Martha Coakley in a hypothetical head-to-head because, of course, we don't yet know who the nominees from either party are going to be. And also that Coakley's lead over her other Democrats in the primary field is narrowing, even though it's still in double digits. So, first of all, what do you make of this new Baker-Coakley virtual tie?
Not surprised. I mean, I'm not surprised to see Charlie Baker doing strongly. He doesn't have he does have a primary opponent, but nobody thinks that Mark Fisher is going to go very far in the primary. Charlie all along has been seen as the establishment Republican candidate and a solid one, a substantial one. As for the race tightening up for the Democratic side, I think all of us expected to see that happen as we got closer and closer to primary day, as the campaign started pouring more and more money into it. At the moment, Coakley's still holding her lead, but I think we're going to see it get smaller and smaller. And I'd say anything could happen in the next 2 weeks.
Well, we've been seeing Steve Grossman really be unrelenting in his criticism.
But not unbecoming
of Martha Coakley. We've got a little tape of one of the Democratic debates that was held at the Boston Herald this week. And here's Grossman reminding Martha Coakley about the fact that she lost a couple years ago, or more than a couple years ago, to Scott Brown in that Senate race.
All I know is that she lost a very big lead with a very small number of days to go, and I think voters will pay attention to that. They want a Democrat who will stand up and take a stand.
John, to me, I mean, yes, that is what happened, but it sounds like Steve Grossman is acting as if Martha Coakley didn't even learn a lesson from that race. We know she has to have.
Well, she learned a lesson, but Grossman's people are still holding a grudge about 2010. And if you look at the Globe poll that came out today, one of the sort of subtexts is that in a general election, Coakley versus Baker, a lot of the Grossman people say they would vote for Charlie Baker, and it all goes back to 2010. So the specter of Scott Brown is still hovering over the Bay State, even though he's gone. The other thing I'll say about Charlie Baker closing the gap with Martha Coakley, that's what $500,000 worth of super PAC ads will do for you. $500,000 of uncontested super PAC ads, basically. I mean, there's been no alternative narrative about Charlie Baker up to this point. Martha Coakley comes out with a web video to counter this latest attack, which is about the gas tax. You know, 400 people have seen the web video. You can't fight television with the web. It just doesn't work. So Charlie Baker's riding a nice wave. You know, Judgment Day will come, and there's a lot of money behind Democratic super PACs. There's one that just reserved $3.1 million of advertising from September 10th to Election Day. They'll be on the air every day. So that's going to level the playing field to some degree. Last thing I'll say is one of the biggest things about this race is super PACs, independent expenditure groups, are going to far outspend the candidates in this one. They're going to hijack this election. And that's going
to
be something.
That seems to be pro forma these days in elections.
It seems to be pro forma, but I don't think we've seen it here in a governor's race before. I think we're going to see it this time.
And increasingly, I wonder, as you know, I've been wondering now every election cycle, how rapid the fall off is in terms of the diminishing returns. As more and more of these kinds of ads flood the airwaves, as more and more of us learn to just tune them out, or not even tune them in to begin with. How much of an it feels as though the impact that they have has got to be getting less and less. Yeah.
Well, let's move on to two more stories from this week. One of them is a happy one. The other one is sadly a tragic one. Let's begin with the good news story, and that is the return of Peter Theo Curtis, I should say, a journalist who had spent almost 2 years as a hostage in Syria. This week, he was released and returned home to his mother's house in Cambridge. He didn't say much, but he did come out and talk for a few minutes with reporters, and here's what he said.
Total strangers have been coming up to me and saying, hey, we're just glad you're home. Welcome home. Glad you're back. Glad you're safe. Great to see you. So I suddenly remember how good the American people are and what kindness they have in their hearts.
So, John, this is, of course, in counterpoint to the death of James Foley, whose video was released, 10 days ago. So what's your reaction to the homecoming of Peter Theo Curtis?
I mean, it's a great story, and it's terrific that he's back. I mean, what strikes me is just the sort of arbitrary and random nature of what's going on in the Middle East at this point. And the whole idea that, you know, James Foley meets one fate, Peter Theo Curtis meets another fate, and there doesn't seem to be much rhyme or reason for either one of them yet. We don't know the story behind Peter Curtis, but
and meanwhile, there's a third one hanging.
Right. Stephen Sotloff is still hanging there. I mean, it reminds me that Bill Malden, the great World War II cartoonist, once had a drawing of two infantrymen with bullets flying all over the place. And one says to the other, I feel like a fugitive from the law of averages. And that's always been true of military combatants, but it hasn't always been true of journalists. And I think that that's a whole new dimension that they're facing now.
Yeah. Well, meanwhile, another reminder this week that you don't really have to go very far to find at all families struggling with tragedy when it comes to the untimely death of their children, because Dawn Jaffier, a young woman who was shot and killed by a stray bullet on Blue Hill Avenue while waiting for a parade Saturday morning, she was a really inspirational young person. And last night, Christiana Torres said at Jaffier's memorial that Dawn was like an older sister.
I'm not going to lie, this is so hard, but I'm doing it for you. I'm going to continue your legacy. I'm going to become the best teacher I can be. I'm going to make a difference in the lives of others, just as you did. And I vow to become a woman you'll be proud of.
Jeff, a little earlier in the show, we heard a bit of tape from Don Jaffier's father, who was saying, like, if only the person who had done this had brought a book to the parade instead of a gun. I mean, it's just heartbreaking to think about, but your thoughts?
I've been struck by the dignity of her father, and also by the, you know, the poignant irony of the fact that here's somebody, the person arrested for shooting her is, I think, an 18-year-old gang member, and she spent all these hours volunteering at a boys and girls club to try to help young people. I mean, it's just as though all the, you know, the furies came together to show how cruel and unfair life can be. I have to say, you know, at the risk of taking a step into, you know, a bit of a politically incorrect reaction, here we've had weeks now of this of all the turmoil in Ferguson. It's a tragic reminder that the reality in this country is that when a black person is killed, it's not a white police officer that you're usually going to point to. Over here, police officers from the city of Boston moved quickly with police work to find a suspect. If this is what it looks like, it's all too typical of what leads to the death of far too many people in this country.
John, do you have a thought about that?
I don't disagree that this is a tragedy. I just feel like there's this tape loop that's going on in Boston, where the same kinds of things keep happening, the same people keep coming forward, the same people keep coming forward to say the same things, and then the same thing happens again. And I think that there's a real sort of depressing aspect to this, that we don't seem to be making the kind of progress that we want to make, that we promise to make, but that somehow we fail to make.
And it's Don Jaffier's father who puts his finger on what would change it. You have to change character. Mm. You have to change the formation of people from the very beginning. And that starts with books and school and teaching and values.
Which is what Dawn was doing with her very own life and the fact that she had been in the teaching profession, at least for a short period of time. Well, on that note, if we can just change gears pretty dramatically, because we do have just enough time for our hubbubs. It's a tough shift here, but let's do it. And those are the stories that fell off the front page, but maybe were worth a mention anyway. So, John, what's your hubbub?
So my hubbub is a big shakeup at WBZ-TV in the news department that nobody seems to know anything about except the Boston Herald, because they're the only one who really covered it. But there was a real game of musical chairs that went on in terms of some of the veterans who have been shunted aside to some degree. David Wade is getting the big chair on one of the evening broadcasts. Paula Eben, Danielle Niles, all of this is sort of the Young Turks coming up. The Herald had it covered pretty well in the inside track. The Globe has not touched it at all. Tonight is Jack Williams' last night in the anchor chair. This one has completely flown under the radar screen, and maybe that's the price you pay for being number three in the ratings, but it seems to me that it's a pretty significant shift in the broadcast news landscape.
Especially given how much local news there has been, you know, high-profile local news in the past several years.
And not to mention what a great guy Jack Williams is.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Your hubbub, Jeff.
President Obama gives a press conference yesterday talking about Iraq. He admitted that he didn't have a strategy, nothing new there. But what was striking about that press conference is he shows up wearing a tan suit, and Twitter world went nuts. In the space of that one press conference, according to the Washington Post, there were more than 4,000 tweets commenting on the president's suit. Tweets like, "The audacity of taupe." tweets like, "This is what happens when Obama bypasses Congress to purchase a suit." Tweets like, "You can't declare war wearing a suit that color." I was laughing aloud as I was reading these tweets that were filed. It goes to show what it is that we regard as truly important to this country. The color of the president's suit, never mind the content of his words.
Yes.
And we're not even past Labor Day. I don't get it.
And if the internets are focused on it, is that legal?
Are you allowed to do that?
It must be the most important thing if Twitter has decided it, right? Well, my hubbub has to do with something which I think is familiar to everybody, and that is the seats on airlines that have no leg room, right? Because twice in the past week, we've had an airline flight diverted after a dispute over someone reclining their seats. Of course, this is in regular coach class.
Knee defender.
And this, well, the knee defender one was the first one. So this second one was a flight that was from Miami bound for Paris. And a passenger became enraged after a woman in front of him reclined her seat. So they had to divert the flight to Boston. And the one of the people was arrested at the airport, and it just went on and on and on. But my favorite thing about this story, other than the fact that everyone can relate, is that I saw on Twitter someone tweeted that diverting a flight to Boston to avoid a fist fight is like diverting a flight to New York to avoid pizza. So, but anyway, I mean,
and one more branch of the Umbridge Industrial Complex, right?
I know, there seems there not be a shortage of branches on that. But I mean, look, the last time I was on a plane, I'm not even that tall. It was horrible. So.
I'd be really mad if I was headed for Paris and I wound up in Boston, I got to tell you.
Maybe we ought to take a lesson from Market Basket and all airline customers join together
here
in solidarity.
At WBR, we can stretch out our legs, stretch our backs, lean back, and not get in trouble.
Well, John Carroll is professor of communications at Boston University. Always great to have you, John.
Likewise.
And Jeff Jacoby, columnist for the Boston Globe. Have a great weekend, Jeff.
Thank you. Great to be here. Happy Labor Day.
Thank you. Stay with us, listeners, as more of the show in just a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.